I wonder, would you turn to Psalm 34? Psalm 34, which is on page 561. Page 561 in the Pew Bible. And as we go through this psalm, I'd be very keen for you to have the Bible open and Psalm 34 in front of you. I think you'll find it helpful. It will certainly help me as I seek to point various verses out as we go through this quite amazing psalm. Psalm 34. And you can see the introduction to the psalm is, it says, a psalm of David, who pretended to be sane before Abimelech. In fact, I think Abimelech is a general name. Either Achish or Abimelech is a general name. It's the same person that Jamie was reading to us about. So, verse 1, I will extol the Lord at all times. His praise will always be on my lips. My soul will boast in the Lord. Let the afflicted hear and rejoice. Glorify the Lord with me. Let us exalt his name together. I sought the Lord, and he answered me. He delivered me from all my fears. Those who look to him are radiant. Their faces are never covered with shame. This poor man called, and the Lord heard him, and saved him out of all his troubles. The angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him, and he delivers them. Taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man who takes refuge in him. Fear the Lord, you his saints, for those who fear him lack nothing. The lions may grow weak and hungry, but those who seek the Lord lack no good thing. Come, my children, listen to me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord. Whoever of you loves life and desires to see many good days, keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking lies. Turn from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it. The eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are attentive to their cry. The face of the Lord is against those who do evil, to cut off the memory of them from the earth. The righteous cry out, and the Lord hears them. He delivers them from all their troubles. The Lord is close to the brokenhearted and saves those who are crushed in spirit. A righteous man may have many troubles, but the Lord delivers him from them all. He protects all his bones. Not one of them will be broken. Evil will slay the wicked. The foes of the righteous will be condemned. The Lord redeems his servants. No one will be condemned who takes refuge in him. Thus ends Psalm 34, which is the word of the Lord. Just by way of introduction, Fearful Thursdays. I think we've got that up. Great. Fearful Thursdays. I'm not sure why Thursdays should be particularly fearful. I think it's Fearful Sunday for me today, but for some people it's Mondays. Mondays can be a very difficult day. Certainly in the days when I was working, Monday was a bad day, and I think those of you who were at school, I don't think Monday's a great day, and you'll look through your program to see what subjects come up, and sometimes there can be subjects that you're really not particularly interested in. They can be quite fearful. So certain days can be fearful for each one of us. And fear is a powerful emotion. It's one that is part of being human, and one that we all experience from time to time, and one that can dominate and cripple us if we let it. And it was certainly an emotion that David knew all about, and it was really largely out of his fear that we have this psalm before us. David also talks about another fear, as you will have picked up, a much more glorious fear, a different fear, a wholly different fear, the fear of the Lord, the blessings that this sort of fear brings with it, and the impact that this sort of fear should have on the way we live. So in many ways, this is a very practical psalm. Just by way of background, we're told, as we have heard, the setting of the psalm and the occasion that caused David to write it, to sit down and write it. And of course, we've just read it. Jamie's just read it for us. David was fleeing from the murderous jealousy of Saul. he went to the coastal area of the Philistines to seek asylum from the king of Gath. And he was probably on his own. The introduction to, or the beginning of chapter 21 talks about David and his men. There was nobody with David. David had just left Jonathan and he was escaping as quickly as he could. So David was probably almost certainly he was on his own. He must have been absolutely at his wit's end and really desperate to have chosen to go to Gath. Why Gath of all places? Maybe he thought this was the very place that Saul wouldn't be looking for him. But Gath of all places, it was the hometown of Goliath, where he had slain the Goliath whom he had slain a few years early. And he couldn't possibly have been thinking clearly because he had with him Goliath's sword. And the very sight of that sword must have been anathema to the folks of Gath. And we know the word of God says that he was in very real danger. And it says he was very afraid of the king of Gath. So he pretended to be insane and eventually escaped to the cave of Adullam. And this may indeed have been the place where he wrote this psalm. But wherever where it was written or where how long after the events, David must have given this psalm really careful thought, because it's an acrostic psalm. An acrostic psalm begins with each verse begins with a letter of the alphabet, successive letter of the alphabet. So we have this wonderful psalm, which is a psalm of testimony to the goodness of God, born out of David's experience of adversity. So David, I think, when he wrote it, intended that we should think about it. So in terms of the outline or the structure of the psalm, I've struggled to provide anything like a simple outline of what actually is quite a complex arrangement of thought and themes woven through these 22 verses. I was actually encouraged by something I read in one of Philip Yancey's books, the Bible that Jesus read. I don't know when any of you have read his book, but he points out that the Psalms are poetry, and they really do not lend themselves to neatly classified and organized concepts and ideas. However, we actually do need some sort of framework. So I propose to explore this psalm under three headings. If I can get this to work. Am I pressing the right one? Nope, wrong way. Oh yes, that's the one. Yeah, that's it. First is David's praise, second is David's testimony from verses 4 to 10, and the third is David's teaching. But in true Irish fashion, I would like to begin by looking at David's testimony first, looking at his teaching second, and then conclude with David's praise, because I think when we've looked at the first two, we might have a better idea of David's praise and understand his praise. So, David's testimony. We'll read that in verses 4 to 10, but I just want to highlight verse 4. There is freedom from fear in verse 4. I sought the Lord and he answered me. He delivered me from all my fears. So David sought the Lord and he answered him and he delivered him from all his fears. And David had many fears. The context of the psalm gives us a good idea what they might be. Fear for his life, for example. He was on the run, living the life of a fugitive, escaping the very real intent that Saul had to try and kill him. And when he was in Gath, there was every reason that the Philistine king should want to kill him. Then perhaps there was fear of the future. Where is this all going to end now? What happened to the good life promised when I was anointed by Samuel? Fear of isolation. He was alone. Even when he fled to the cave of Adullam, he was on his own, at least for a short while. It seems that his fears led him what seemed to be the lowest point of his life thus far, for it affected his integrity. He fled to Nob, where he told a succession of lies to the priest in order to gain food and a sword. He had no men with him, and he told lies. He wasn't on a mission. He certainly wasn't on escaping from King Saul. So he told this string of lies, and it affected his integrities. And it led to irrational behavior. Who in their right mind would have gone to the hometown of Goliath, the hero of the Philistine, and that king had killed a few years earlier? It seems that his fears dominated his thinking and really had the potential to dictate his behavior and destroy his life. You know, fear is the first negative emotion that we read about in the Bible. You remember the story? After Adam and Eve sinned, they hid from God among the trees in the garden. When God called to Adam, "Where are you?" Adam's reply was, "I heard you in the garden, and I was afraid, because I was naked, so I hid." That was the very beginning of irrational behavior brought about by fear and the strategy that so often we adopt of trying to cover up and hiding. I suppose the question comes, what about me? What about you? What are the fears? What are your fears? And how do you deal with your fears? For some, it's fear of failure. And I think in school and in the workplace, that's a very common fear. For some, it's a fear of rejection. The underlying reason for many fears, and that was in a sense the underlying fear for Adam and Eve. They feared that God would reject them and no longer accept them. Fears for the future with so many unknowns, so many uncertainties. For some, it might be the fear of growing old. For others, the fear of ill health. And even for some, the fear of death. For some, it's the fear of change. For many, this is a very real fear. I want to read you a letter of someone who was very frightened of change. He actually wrote to the President of the United States, and it was actually a letter from the Governor of New York. But it's dated the 31st of January, 1829. So that is the context of this letter. To President Jackson, the canal system of this country is being threatened by a new form of transportation known as railroads. The federal government must preserve the canals for the following reasons. One, if canal boats are supplanted by railroads, serious unemployment will result. Captains, cooks, drivers, hostelers, repairmen, and dock tenders will be left without means of livelihood, not to mention the numerous farmers now employed in growing hay for the horses. Two, boat builders would suffer, and tow line, whip, and harness makers would be left destitute. Three, canal boats are absolutely essential to the defense of the United States. In the event of the expected trouble with England, the Erie Canal will be the only means by which we could ever move supplies so vital to waging modern war. As you well know, Mr. President, railroad carriages are pulled at the enormous speed of 15 miles per hour by engines, which, in addition to endangering life and limb of passengers, roar and snort their way through the countryside, setting fire to crops, scaring livestock, and frightening men and women. The Almighty surely never intended that people should travel at such breakneck speed. We can laugh at that, can't we? Because we have the benefit of hindsight and have a perspective that the writer of that letter actually never had. Our fears need to be corrected by having a new and a different and a divine perspective. A perspective that David had, a perspective that came from his dependence and trust that God heard his prayers and was in ultimate control of his circumstances. If you look at the first part of verse 4, I sought the Lord and he answered me. He goes on to say, and the Lord delivered me from all my fears. David brought all his fears to God. And if David did it, so must we. Did his fears disappear at once, do you think? I suspect not. Certainly not if our own experience is anything to go by. His deliverance was undoubtedly a part of a process of growing trust and commitment. What David says in verse 5, just read verse 5. Those who look unto him are radiant. Their faces are never covered with shame. What David is in effect saying, anyone who does the same can be free from their fears and the shame that accompanies irrational behavior and fear-dominated behavior can be escaped. So that's the first point. Second part of David's testimony is there is help in time of trouble. Look at verse 6. This poor man called, and the Lord heard him and saved him out of all his troubles. David was in all sorts of trouble, and most of it was not of his own making. He was forced to run for his life and live the life of a fugitive. His only crime was that he was successful at his job and more popular than Saul, and Saul was determined to get rid of him. As a result, he lost a number of things. He lost his job. He was a commanding officer in Saul's army. He lost his place in society. He was in the court of the king at that time. He lost his security and all he knew, his home, his identity as a senior officer, his income. He could go on. He probably lost his reputation. And he was separated from his friends and his family. No wonder David calls himself this poor man. We get a clue to his state of mind. Look at verse 18. The Lord is close to the brokenhearted and saves those who are crushed in spirit. David must have been brokenhearted. He must have felt crushed in his spirit. He had no resources. He was utterly helpless, but he wasn't hopeless. He was aware that the Lord was close to the brokenhearted. He called to God and God heard him and saved him from all his troubles. Notice David did not say out of his troubles. Notice David says out of his troubles, not from them. David's circumstances did not change immediately. He remained a fugitive and in danger for a long time. He was delivered from Achish, and he did escape to the cave of Adullam, where supporters and family eventually joined him. His grim circumstances gradually improved, and in time he did become king. I think there is a very important lesson for us here this evening. The promise of prayer does not mean that God will change every difficult situation or circumstance in our lives. We all know that from our own experience. But he will transform even the difficult circumstances by his presence. And sometimes he'll send others along to help us. The third part of David's testimony, there is protection amid evil. Verse 7, the angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him and he delivers them. David appears to have a similar insight into the unseen spiritual world that Elisha had some 200 years later. You remember the story of Elisha, I'm sure. The king of Aram sent an army to capture Elisha. At night they surrounded the city where they were staying, and in the morning when Elisha saw what had happened, he said to Elisha, "Oh my God, oh my Lord, what shall I do?" Elisha's response was, "Don't be afraid. Those who are with us are more than those who are with them." And then Elisha prayed to God. And he said, "Oh Lord, open his eyes that he may see. And when the Lord opened his servant's eyes, and he looked and saw the hills full of horses and chariots of fire around Elisha. There is an unseen spiritual world that is real. A spiritual world of angels and of heavenly hosts. And we're only ever given what is a tantalizing glimpse of this throughout the Bible. You remember what Jesus said to Peter in Gethsemane as Peter sought to take matters into his own hands and drew his sword? Jesus said, "Put your sword back in its place. Do you think I cannot call on my Father and he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels?" Some interpretations put that at 80,000 angels. So there is a real spiritual world out there, and there is protection amid peril. So as we conclude this brief look at David's testimony of freedom, of deliverance, and of protection, it is little wonder that he encourages all in verse 8 to taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man who takes refuge in him. So that's David's testimony. What about David's teaching? And there are two themes, at least, that I discovered looking through David's teaching. The first one is the fear of the Lord, verses 11 to 14. Verse 11 says, "Come, my children, listen to me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord." You will notice that this is a key theme of David's. It's also in verse 7 and 9, as well as in verse 11. And this is obviously a totally different fear from the one that we've been thinking about. It's not about fright, and it's not about terror. This sort of fear promises to bring with it amazing blessings. Another psalmist said, "The Lord delights in those who fear him, who put their hope in his unfailing love." You'll know the proverb that says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom." So it's obviously very important that we understand what it means to fear the Lord. Equally important is it seems to be something that we can learn. So what exactly is the fear of the Lord? If I were to put up a flip chart here this evening and get you to call out words that we might associate with the fear of the Lord, I think an audience like this might come up with a fairly comprehensive list. We might have words and phrases like profound reverence, awe, deep honor, or respect. Also, perhaps recognition of God's character expressed in words like creator, holiness, power, love, mercy, judgment, wrath. I think we could conclude that it has to do with an attitude of heart that gives proper recognition to the full character of God. But you'll notice that David's teaching in verse 13 and 14 makes it clear it's not just about attitude, but it's about action. And he points out three things we need to do. First, be watchful with your words. Be watchful with your words. In verse 13, keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking lies. Words have incredible power, and how we use them can have enormous impact, with consequences that go on for years, whether they be good or for evil. Proverbs 12 says, "Reckless words pierce like a sword, but the tongue of the wise brings healing." And Proverbs 15 says, "The tongue that brings healing is a tree of life, but a deceitful tongue crushes the spirit." James, the brother of Jesus, has a lot to say about the tongue in his letter. He's a lot to say about controlling the tongue, how this little member of the body has got so much power in it. He illustrates it in positive ways, how a small thing like a rudder is used to turn a large ship, or how a bit in the mouth of a horse allows you to control the horse. And then in a negative way, he talks about how a great forest can be set on fire by a tiny spark. Paul gives some advice to the Christians in Ephesus. He says, "Do not let any unwholesome talk come from your mouths, but only what is helpful for building others up according to their needs, that it may benefit those who listen." So there are some key questions when we speak. Is it true? Is it helpful? Is it necessary? So, the fear of the Lord is about watching our words. The second thing that David tells us is be careful with your conduct. Turn from evil and do good. Verse 14, turn from evil and do good. We are confronted every day with the opportunities to toy with evil in a whole host of ways, through thought, through our words, and through our deeds. But David says, don't toy with it. He says, turn from it. Do you know that there are God-prepared opportunities for every one of us to do good? Ephesians 2:10 says this, "For we are God's handiwork, created in Christ Jesus to do good works, which God prepared beforehand for us to do." So God has already prepared tasks for each one of us to do if we are in tune and prepared to listen to what he says. The third thing that David teaches us about the fear of the Lord is be active as a peacemaker. Be active as a peacemaker. Verse 14, the second part of verse 14, seek peace and pursue it. This is not about being passive and assuming that the absence of some sort of conflict or trouble means peace. Peace and seek and pursue are strong action words here and require us to be proactive as peacemakers. Because we are all from different backgrounds and because we're wired up differently and we'll have different views, conflict is going to be an inevitable part of life, both in the family and at school and at college and in the workplace and sadly in the church. And Paul exhorts Christians in Rome to make every effort to do what leads to peace and to mutual edification. And again in Hebrews, make every effort to live in peace with all men and to be holy. And it involves effort. Being a peacemaker involves effort. But how does this look in practice? When Peter wrote his letter to give some instructions on relating to others and godly living, he quoted this passage verbatim. So let's just turn to 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 10, if you can do that. 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 10. Well, actually, verse 8, and Graham Davis actually read this passage to us on Monday, last Monday, at the officers' meeting. Verses 8 and 9, really. Peter says, "Finally, all of you, live in harmony with each other. Be sympathetic. Love as brothers. Be compassionate and humble. Do not repay evil with evil or insult with insult, but with blessing, because to this you were called, so that you may inherit a blessing for." And then he goes on to quote the exact passage that we've been looking at. So that's David's teaching in relation to the fear of the Lord. Let's just move on to the second aspect of his teaching. The blessings for the righteous, verses 15 to 22. The words righteous and righteousness are really not in the vocabulary of our society today. But they are key Bible words appearing in the Old Testament no less than 356 times and something like 150 times in the New Testament. So before we look at what the blessings are, we need to answer the important question, who is David talking about? And who are the righteous? If you look at the dictionary, you'll find that it defines the word righteous as something like this, as an adjective that describes a person's conduct with words like morally right, virtuous, or law-abiding. But the Bible takes that to a completely different level. In Deuteronomy, when Moses was giving the people the Ten Commandments, he also instructs them to love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. So he goes on to say, this, and if we are careful to obey all this law before the Lord our God, as he has commanded us, that will be our righteousness. That will be our righteousness. So clearly, the righteous are those who seek to love God and obey his commandments. But I think there is something more. In Genesis, we read of God's promise to Abraham that he would have a son and become the father of a mighty nation. And the Bible records that Abraham believed the Lord and he credited it to him as righteousness. So righteousness also includes a belief and trust in the promises of God. And of course, as we read this psalm from the perspective of the New Testament, looking back to the cross, we too can include ourselves as righteous, not because of anything that we have done or can ever do, but because the Lord Jesus, who was the righteous one, became our sacrifice that we might become the righteousness of God. So as we look at the blessings of the righteous that David highlights, we can make them our own. The first one is God sees our need. The eyes of the Lord are on the righteous. Second one, God hears our cries in verses 15 and 17. His ears are attentive to their cry. Thirdly, God delivers us from troubles, verses 17 and 19. The righteous man may have many troubles, but the Lord delivers him from them all. Fourthly, God is close to those in distress. The Lord is close to the brokenhearted and saves those who are crushed in spirit. And then God redeems his servants, verse 22. No one will be condemned who takes refuge in him. And so that brings us back to David's praise. David's praise, verses 1 to 3. Let's just see what David says in verses 1 to 3. I will extol the Lord at all times. His praise will always be on my lips. My soul will boast in the Lord. Let the afflicted hear and rejoice. Glorify the Lord with me. Let us exalt his name together. So having looked at the rest of the psalm, I think we're now in a better place to understand why David begins with such exuberant praise. And little wonder as we look at his experiences of God. God hears and answers our cries. He delivers from fear, verse 4. He rescues from trouble, 5 and 19. He protects from the enemy. He provides for our needs. He knows our situation. He is close to us in our extremities, verse 18. And verse 22, he redeems his people. What an amazing song for a fearful Thursday or Monday or Tuesday or any day of the week. But before I close, I want to bring a final challenge. As we conclude, I would like to leave actually three simple challenges. The first really is to those of you who have a vague or distant knowledge of God, who really don't understand the fear of the Lord, or what it means to be righteous. Do you know, David's God can be your God. David says, taste and see that the Lord is good. Take refuge in God through the Lord Jesus Christ. The second challenge comes to those of us who know and who love God and who seek to live in the fear of the Lord. The challenge really comes from what David has said to us, to develop and cultivate our attitude by learning more of the character of God. And in our actions, by the words we say, our conduct, and by being peacemakers. And finally, to share this great news with others, with someone else. Amazing news. How can they hear unless someone tells them?